Hello and welcome to the 1740 podcast. I'm Maudie Lowe and I'm here with Alexander Waugh. And today we're going to continue with part two of our introductory level episode about the authorship problem. Our most popular episode so far on our 1740 podcast has been Where There's a Will, There's a War. And in that episode, we broke down the authorship question and honed in on the man from Stratford. For our listeners, if you haven't already listened to the episode, then we highly recommend you listen to it before this one. As always, please do share this podcast with anyone you think may find it interesting. Alexander, in this episode, I'd love you to break down who you think wrote the works attributed to Shakespeare. So, without further ado, who wrote the works?
Well, I hate to be annoying and arrogant and put people's backs up right at the very first sentence that I make on this podcast, but I've gone beyond the point of who I think wrote the works of Shakespeare. We know who drove it. That doesn't mean I know who wrote every single Shakespeare sentence, because he worked with a scriptorium of writers. That means a group of scholars who were clever, who knew how to write verse, who knew history, and who all came together, a bit like modern films are made like that nowadays, modern Hollywood films. You get people sitting around a table all throwing their tuppenny halfpenny worth in. And this man was Edward de Vere. Edward de Vere was, and people shudder at this sometimes, but he was an aristocrat. People shudder because they're foolish and they don't understand that the modern aristocrat is a very different animal from an aristocrat in the 16th, 17th century. In the 16th, 17th century, an aristocrat had an abounding duty to arms and to commonwealth. His duty was to his country. He wasn't someone who simply loafed about with a great estate and a lot of money coming in for free that he had inherited and talking in a drawl and shooting at pigeons and pheasants. He was a man whose absolute body and soul were devoted to king or queen or monarch or country and commonwealth and to helping the commonwealth. And one of the interesting things about the Shakespeare phenomenon is that Shakespeare wasn't simply an entertainer in the same way that you might get someone who writes modern plays and puts them on and you all go to the theatre and pay your ticket and have a lovely time at the theatre. He was, as I say, someone who was trying to elevate England. And when you go back in the history of England at that time, you'll notice that the English were rather chippy. They felt, isn't it irritating, that the French seem to be rather cleverer than us and rather better at poetry and rather better at architecture and rather better at painting, ditto the Italians. Isn't it irritating that so long before that, the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans were so much better at writing plays and writing poetry? And why would we have to learn everything from them? Why can't we, the British, be great? And so there was a very, very deliberate attempt in the Elizabethan age, pushed by not just Elizabeth, but primarily her ministers, Francis Walsingham, her spymaster, and William Cecil, her treasurer, and a very clever man called Nicholas Bacon, who was the father of the famous philosopher Francis Bacon, and someone called Roger Ascham. And these were very clever, learned people, mainly out of Cambridge University, who decided to make it a policy that the British culture, British science, everything about Britain, British language, English, I should say, probably, would raise itself to the high grade of the Italians and the French and the ancient Romans and the ancient Greeks. So you have to see Shakespeare as part of that. He fits into that policy to raise the country. And by raising the country, you're raising the people. You know, in the olden days, people went to the theatre and they screwed around with prostitutes and wasted money and bought, well, I don't know if they had things like bubble gum in those days, but they probably got themselves drunk and misbehaved and spent most of the day at the theatre. And this was noticed by the government, particularly the government noticing people of importance, people like lawyers, people like captains, people like courtiers, were wasting their time at the public theatre. So they deliberately set out, this is a government policy, set out to say, we must elevate what goes on in the theatres. The theatres must teach people how to speak our language beautifully, how to inform and enrich and enlarge in our vocabulary. So that's what actually happened, and that was a policy of government. Now you've got to ask yourself, well, who would you get to run this policy of government? Is it likely you'd go up to Stratford-upon-Avon and find a man called William Shakespeare of Stratford, who probably couldn't read or write, who certainly shows no evidence he could read or write. I know we discussed this in a previous program. And his daughters, who didn't know how to read and write, and say, hey-ho, you funny little man, can you come out of your farming world and teach the whole of this country how to elevate itself through plays and through poetry and through understanding of classical literature and all these things? Obviously not. The person you would choose would be probably among the greatest scholars among you. Now, the greatest scholar among the young courtiers who happened to be completely in love with poetry and with the theatre was Edward de Vere. Edward de Vere was the youngest man of his generation to be awarded, prized by both Oxford and Cambridge University. He was literally less than a teenager when this happened. His scholarship was absolutely remarkable. And among the great scholars of his age, they bowed down to this man. One of them said, he's addicted to scholarship. So he knew history, geography, languages. When you start looking at the Shakespeare plays, and you see how at least 14 of them are set in Italy, and how the writer of them has clearly read books that were not even available in English. You know, they're Italian books, for instance, that they had never been translated into English. So whoever wrote them and based them on those stories knew the Italian originals. They knew Plautus, who was a Latin writer of comedy. The Menechmi is one of the plays that Comedy of Errors is based upon. You couldn't do that unless you could read Latin. I keep going back to poor old Stratford Shakespeare, but there's no evidence he actually went to school to read Latin. Well, I say there's no evidence. Let's be as fair can possibly be. The evidence occurs 150 years after his death, when a man who lied and pretended he went to Stratford to discover it didn't actually go to Stratford and came back saying he thought that he may have been at the grammar school until the age of 13, but that is not significantly enough to be able to translate the Menechmi of Plautus and turn it into an extremely yes. clever English play.
And, of course, Edward de Vere's uncle was very important too. His name was Arthur Golding, and he translated Ovid.
Yes, and Edward de Vere's family is very literary. People often say about me that I come from a literary family. My father was a writer, my mother was a writer, my grandfather was a writer, my great-grandfather was a writer, and these things happen in many, many different professions. People stick within their families to their professions. Of course, I'm not saying for an instant, if you come from a literary family, you can automatically become a great or famous or interesting writer. But my God, it helps. And it's almost, well, I wouldn't say it's almost, I would say it is impossible to be brought up in a family that can't read or write. And we know that Shakespeare of Stratford's father can't read or write. And become the greatest writer in the world. I mean, you need to be at a table every day where vocabulary is being used and stretched and exercised, where corrections are being made to your faulty English by bossy parents, etc., etc. So it wasn't just that Edward de Vere's uncle was a very literary man who made lots of translations and famously translated the works of Ovid, and we know that Ovid was Shakespeare's favourite poet, Latin poet. But Edward de Vere's uncle was also a very good poet called Lord Surrey, who invented what we now call the Shakespearean sonnet. Another of his uncles, called Lord Sheffield, was a very good poet and a songwriter. Henry VIII, after Henry VIII died, there was a huge fury with Edward de Vere's father, who decided it would be rather more fun to go and watch a play and put on a play at his house than go to the funeral and take the funeral seriously. And the Vere family, which comes from Essex originally, was one of the first grand families to have its own theatre troupe, its own theatre company, where they entertained the Queen at Headingham Castle, which was their seat. to theatre and plays. And there was, in those days, we've totally forgotten him now, but in those days there was a famous playwright called John Bale. And Bale wrote the prototype, the original play of King John, upon which Shakespeare bases his King John. And a lot of people have had to ask, well, how on earth did Shakespeare of Stratford get hold of John Bale's copy, which was only in manuscript, of the play of King John in order to write his King John? That copy of that play was donated by Bale to Vere's ancestors. It belonged to the Vere family. You know, everything, once you start looking at this question critically and with a challenging and unbiased eye, everything plops into place and you realise that Edward de Vere simply had to be the driving force behind Shakespeare. No one else could have done it. And of course, he was remarked upon at the time as a famous playwright. We have at least three printed sources saying that he was among the best playwrights we have. And yet we're told that all his plays have been lost. All of Edward de Vere's, the best playwright I've got, all his plays have been lost. Oh ho. And what's this big book over here? Oh, it's by someone called William Shakespeare, who never claimed to be a playwright in his life. 36 plays. And the man's disappeared. William Shakespeare has disappeared from the history of playwriting. He doesn't exist in that history. Edward de Vere does, and all his plays have disappeared, so it doesn't take a huge amount of imagination to wonder whether the one doesn't belong to the other.
With any writer, we always focus on their lives and their work to understand how their experience and influence fashioned their work. How do the works of Shakespeare reflect the life of Edward de Vere?
I think that's a very important question, and particularly with works that are written primarily for adults. I mean, I know children get a lot of enjoyment out of Shakespeare plays, and it's one of the magical aspects of Shakespeare plays. But they are fundamentally adult works, and their lines are quite difficult and sometimes quite erudite. And I think it is impossible for a grown-up person to write a serious adult drama, novel, whatever, without bringing their own experience and their own life and their own observation into it. My grandfather, who was Evelyn Waugh's famous novelist, took different characters that he knew throughout his life and didn't base one of a character in his novel entirely on a character from his life, but he tended to merge them together in a kaleidoscopic way. You could say of Evelyn Waugh, and you could even say the same of Shakespeare. They didn't really have an imagination in one sense. They had a kaleidoscopic mind that took fragments from one thing they saw over here, or one joke that someone made, and then and another joke that someone else made. And they were able, in a sense, to create characters out of melding characters that they knew characters together. And, by the way, I'm talking about Evelyn Waugh because, not just because he's my grandfather and I'm trying to boast about him, but I'm talking about him because I'm the editor of 43-volume scholarly edition of his work, so I just happen to know more about Evelyn Waugh and his creative process and Shakespeare and his creative process than any other two writers, and I'm always rather interested by how similar the techniques seem to have been and how they've done it. And both Shakespeare and Evelyn Waugh used their fiction, Somerset Maugham was another one, to get rid of the anxieties and tensions and problems in their lives. I think it was Somerset Maugham who said the writer is the only man who's actually born free, because everyone else has their irks and their problems and their boredoms and their irritations with life. But the writer sits down and he writes it out, and then by doing that he liberates himself. And certainly you get, with Shakespeare, a huge sense of confessing his life through his works. So Edward de Vere had a rickety life. He was, like a lot of geniuses, very bad with money. I won't say he was very bad with people, because he had extremely loyal friends who loved him and adored him. They all knew he was difficult. They all knew he was a problem, but they were loyal to him. And that loyalty says something. Same with Evelyn Waugh. Evelyn Waugh is often talked about as someone who put everybody's backs up by being sort of snobbish and boring and tiresome and Catholic. But, I mean, he had more friends than I would be able to accumulate in a million lifetimes who worshipped him. They knew he was the problem. And I feel exactly the same with Edward de Vere, actually. And there were people who, just as with Evelyn Waugh and with Byron and other complicated genius, and with Shakespeare, hated him. And so Edward de Vere had many very bitter enemies. And there were people who were very cruel to him. He was one among the most generous people, as geniuses very often are, very, very generous people, giving freely of his money, nurturing other people with sparks of genius in them. And when Edward de Vere went bust, or very, very nearly went bust on a number of occasions because he was so bad with money, he found that the people he had been so generous to turned against him. And of course, this is what the play, the Shakespeare play, Timon of Athens, is all about. How they turned against him when he had been so generous to them. And that is just one of many examples of the plays where Edward de Vere confesses his life and what went wrong through it. I think the most autobiographical of them all is probably Hamlet. There are rumours, we can't prove it, that Edward de Vere's father was knocked off, was murdered, actually, by Lord Leicester. Leicester comes out of Hamlet as the wicked Claudius, the stepfather, if you remember in the story, who says to Hamlet, yes, after Hamlet's father's died and Hamlet's weeping about it, he says, "Stop blubbing about it. You know, I'm your father now. You can deal with it. Don't be wet. Don't be so pathetic." And he basically, Lord Leicester, took control with the Queen's approval of Edward de Vere's finances. So again, when one says, well, Edward de Vere was useless over money, it was partly Leicester's fault. Leicester, by the time Edward de Vere had come of age of 21, when he was allowed to actually have his estates, found them pretty well busticated by Leicester, who had plundered them. So he plays the part of Claudius. Of course, I know that Claudius marries Hamlet's mother, which doesn't exactly happen in Edward de Vere's life, but a very similar incident does happen, that Edward de Vere's mother marries precipitately, very, very quickly, the land agent at Castle Hedingham, who also connives with Lord Leicester to deprive Oxford of his rightful inheritance. Now, we can all sit around blubbing about Oxford and his inheritance, but it's all a jolly good thing. I don't think if Oxford had got all his inheritance and everything had worked out his way, we would have Shakespeare, so probably all worked yes. out for the best.
Looking at the pseudonym side of things, why would Edward de Vere have chosen to publish his works under another name?
This is a good question. It's a question that comes up quite a lot, and it puts me into an awkward position because I quite like just banging out boring old facts for people, and I do have a lot of facts at my fingertips. But when you ask me this question, you're asking me to get inside the mind of someone 400 years ago and ask him why did he choose to be anonymous, and I'm not a mind reader. But I can take some educated guesses if you want. Yes, and there are, I believe, a large number of reasons why this happened. First of all, I've already explained to you that he was confessing his life through his works. I've also explained to you that I think he was running a sort of quasi-propaganda department for the government. Now, at that point already, do you want one of the top earls of your country, a top courtier, to be known to the general public, to be running a propaganda department through the theatres and also confessing their own grubby life through their works? I don't think you do. So even before we've got to his reasons for using a pseudonym, I would probably have thought, I'm guessing, that the Queen and the Privy Council, who were sanctioning this propaganda work through the theatres, would have said that they would demand that he would go under a pseudonym and not let it be known abroad that he was the person who was driving these plays. The other thing is there was a culture that an aristocrat or a courtier worked, as I said at the beginning of this talk, or conversation, that they worked for free for the government, that it was their duty to work for free for the government. Yes, the Queen did slip them money here and there, but never ostensibly for doing this or for doing that. You know, the Queen made grants to her courtiers and then said to the courtier, could you be very kind and go and run the East of England for me? And here's a present that's actually disconnected. But of course, they're not disconnected.
Yeah.
Now, the extraordinary thing about Edward de Vere is he goes almost spectacularly bust in 1586. And it is exactly that year that £1,000 a year that was previously being shuffled to the Exchequer, and the Exchequer was paying into the Revels Office. Now, the Revels Office is the office at court that pays for all the plays to be put on. They were paying £1,000. The Exchequer was paying £1,000 a year into the Revels Office. Suddenly, they stop paying that, and the Queen says, I'm going to give Edward de Vere £1,000 a year. And it's in exactly that year, 1886, that we find Edward de Vere surrounding himself with scholar playwrights, people who we haven't really heard of so much nowadays, but they were well-known playwrights in their day. I suppose the most famous one would be Christopher Marlowe, but also people like John Lilly, Anthony Mundy, Thomas Churchyard. Don't worry if listeners haven't heard of these people now. We've all heard of Shakespeare, and some of us have heard of Marlowe, but on the whole, they've lost their fame. But these were highly respectable scholar playwrights, and they were all sitting around Edward de Vere's table during the late 1580s. While Edward de Vere was being paid £1,000 a year, and while he was patron of his own theatre troupe, the Queen's Majesty's Chapel Troupe, St Paul's Troupe, he was by far and away the most influential patron of theatre during the late 1580s, and he was known as a playwright at the same time. So you see how this is all piecing together?
Yes, and £1,000 a year was a lot.
Well, it was a lot, but not enough for him still not to keep going bust. I think he was spending a lot of money in her court to put these plays on.
Was there any support or acknowledgement from de Vere's contemporaries that it might suggest he was a playwright, or that he had connections to the works attributed to Shakespeare?
Yes, there's a lot. And there's been a huge amount of back-heeling among the so-called Stratfordian Shakespeare scholars to try and deny this and to hide the fact that everyone who wrote about Shakespeare at the time, contemporaries, knew perfectly well that Edward de Vere was writing them. And it is absolutely, to me, one of the most extraordinary parts of this whole story that truth has been, I won't say it's been well covered up, it's been ignored. A very learned friend of mine, who I'm extremely fond of, American professor called Roger Stripmatter, and I have been writing a book together for best part of 8 years, actually now finished. It's in 3 volumes, called The Shakespeare Illusion Book. And what we've done in that book is to go through every single reference to Shakespeare, contemporary reference, to see what they're saying. What are people actually saying about Shakespeare? And all of the Shakespeare scholars, whatever side of the authorship debate you fall on, agree that they're talking rather cryptically. And when you ask them and say, well, why? Why, Professor Sir Stanley Wells, are we having to talk cryptically about William Shakespeare? He says, oh, I don't know, but I just don't really understand it, da-di-da-di-da-di-da. He just got to open his eyes and concentrate. He's an English literature professor, and one of his duties is to look at recondite and difficult bits of literature and understand what they're saying. Well, it took Roger and I 5 seconds almost practically on every single one of these references, of which, by the way, there are over 170 of them, to show that every single one of them was talking cryptically, because they were not allowed to say that this man was running a propaganda department and was writing these plays, or at least heading up the writing of these plays. But when you look carefully at what they're saying, they're just, you know, they're using quite simple little tricks, you know, double meanings, There are all sorts of ways of speaking double, and you can see that every single one of them knew perfectly well. So it was, I think is what you would call an open secret at the time. I think what confused matters, well, there are two things that confused matters enormously, actually. One is that there were about eight people in England at the time called William Shakespeare. So we're not dealing with a straightforward pseudonym. You know, if you just called him Mr. Blobby, we would have all known that that was a pseudonym from quite early on. But he was called William Shakespeare. And there were some people in England called William Shakespeare. More confusing than that is 7 years after William Shakespeare, as he should be called, because he didn't use this medially, 7 years after he died, the great first folio of 36 plays, of Shakespeare plays, was published. And the people who wrote the prefatory material, that sort of glowing poems and things like that in the beginning of the book, teased the reader by hinting that they might be talking about a William Shakespeare from Stratford-upon-Avon. So they actually mention a Stratford monument, for instance. And that, and they mention Sweet Swan of Avon on a different page.
Right.
So, as we all know now, Avon is actually another name for Hampton Court. They're talking about a court poet anyway. So it's but it's all tricks within tricks and games within games. But it did put people slightly off balance because we're talking about an allonym. An allonym is the name of a real person that you falsely attribute a play or something to them, whereas a pseudonym is just a completely invented name. So they seem to have taken the name of a real person. That was the first problem. The second problem, which really I think few could have envisaged, was the introduction of the Commonwealth period, in which the Puritans decided that the theatre was immoral and bad. And so they closed down the whole theatres from about 1642 till 1660, the Restoration, when Charles II came back as king. So that's a whole generation. That's 18 years of no plays. And that was not the period to go rushing to the authorities and saying, oh, please, please, can we have our plays back? Because there's this fantastic playwright called William Shakespeare. But guess what? He was really actually the Earl of Oxford, and Queen Elizabeth really loved him and thought he was absolutely brilliant. And they're going to say, get lost. We're not having this crap. So that muddied the waters again even further.
And Henry Peacham listed Oxford at the top of the Elizabethan poets in The Complete Gentleman, I believe.
The Complete Gentleman is a very interesting little book published in 1622, if I remember correctly, which is a guidebook for gentlemen, how to behave, how to catch fish, how to go hunting, how to fly kites, I don't know what. But it has a listing about literature and agrees that literature is important for gentlemen to read. And it has a section in that in which it says the greatest poets of the Elizabethan age are this one, that one, this one, that one, this one, that one, this one. And he names them all. And guess who's top of the list? Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford. And guess who's completely absent from that list? William Shakespeare. So it's as though Peacham knows perfectly well who Shakespeare is. Yeah. And Peacham doesn't let go. Peacham actually had already written a book called Minerva Britanna, which had been published in 1612, 10 years earlier. And this is a book of drawings, very, I would say, mystical drawings. They're actually called emblemata, but they're puzzles and they're great fun. I think you know it. I think
you've seen this book, haven't you? Yes.
And they have little poems underneath, and the drawings are very mystical, and you can spend hours on each drawing trying to work out what the underlying message is. And right on the front cover of that book, Peacham's book, you have a hand coming out from behind a theatre curtain, which is writing a very strange Latin message, which by anagram can be translated Tibi nom de Vere. Your name is de Vere. Now, can we remember what the original Latin says? In translation, it's with the eye you shall be seen. Something like that. He's asking you to look for an eye. I remember it now. Mente visibori is what it says. Mente visibori. With mind, I shall be seen. Now that's very clever in itself. Because mente visibori means nothing in Latin. Mente vidibor means with the mind you shall be seen. He's added an I on the end, the letter I. He's saying, look for the letter I, see if you can find the letter I. And the I is the picture of the hand coming in. It's Edward de Vere, your name is de Vere. I'm not sure I've described that very well, but if anyone can go online and have a look at it, it's called Minerva Britannia, and it's the front page, and it really is worth having a look at it.
And you've done a YouTube video on that one as well.
Yes, yes, yeah. I have.
Is it Henry Peacham New?
That's right. I've done. God, the titles of my videos are so boring. I'm amazed anybody ever bothered to look at any of them. But I put about 60 videos out, and I'm proud to see that they've been viewed by over 1 million people so far. And the comments underneath are very glowing and praiseworthy. I think people really do enjoy them. But why I say they're boring is they're all called People New that nobody's ever heard of. So Henry Peacham New or John Cook New or someone new means absolutely nothing. But what each of those videos shows is a contemporary of William Shakespeare, who knew perfectly well that Edward de Vere was William Shakespeare. And I explain in those videos exactly how we know that that person knew that Edward de Vere was using the pseudonym William Shakespeare.
Are there any historical documents or accounts that directly link Edward de Vere to the plays and sonnets?
The life of Edward de Vere is deeply, deeply ingrained into what is said in the sonnets, which were written in the first person, and into lots of what go on in the plays. But there was unquestionably been an effort to cover up the connection between Edward de Vere and the plays and the sonnet. I may be, but I don't want to raise people's hopes, onto a document that connects Edward de Vere with William Shakespeare of Stratford, in terms of Shakespeare being a servant who was receiving payments from Edward de Vere. Until I've seen the document that I have been told exists, I'm rather fain, not wishing to sort of talk about it too much. I will blow the trumpet very hard as and when I find it. I believe it exists, and there are various people, in fact, I think, including you, Maudie, who are searching for it now, aren't you?
Absolutely.
That would be a big news item if we find it.
Fingers crossed. I'd just like to ask a question or two about the folio. Is it true that all three of Edward de Vere's daughters were engaged to the three dedicatees of Shakespeare's works?
Do you know, I think he had four daughters, but one died really early. But I think there were definitely connections. There was the suggestion that one of them marry Lord Pembroke, the oldest one, called Elizabeth. That in itself is quite interesting because Lord Pembroke is one of the dedicatees, as you know. So the first folio, for those who aren't aware of this, this was the book of 36 plays that is published in 1623, 7 years after the death of irrelevant Stratford Shakespeare. And, Edward de Vere died in 1604, so that's 19 years after the death of Edward de Vere. And one of the dedicatees of that book is William Lord Pembroke. The other is his brother. William Lord Pembroke was engaged, or proposed to be engaged, to one of Edward de Vere's daughters. And his younger brother, Philip, who was Lord Montgomery, actually married what I like to call the Cordelia of Edward de Vere's three daughters. She was a rather sweet, youngest, faithful one who... his mother died when she was very young indeed. And she was called Susan. So that is in itself extremely strange. The first folio of Shakespeare, the second greatest book, or the second most read and most influential book in the English language after the 1611 King James Bible, happens to be dedicated to Edward de Vere's son-in-law. And yes, there was a third daughter, and she married someone called Lord Berkshire, but that's a rather sad story, which we can gloss over because it ended with someone, I think, pushing an arrow through his head.
Oh.
Did he commit suicide?
Probably with an arrow through his head.
Yes, I think he had a crossbow. I think he shot himself with a crossbow.
Oh, gosh. I'd like to also touch upon the dates of the plays. I know this has been a bone of contention for a lot of Stratfordians. They tend to say that Edward Trevor couldn't have written the plays because the dates of the plays, they can't prove that they were written after 1604.
Well, what these people, who correctly call Stratfordians, meaning they are allied to the Dick Whittington fairy tale myth of Stratford-upon-Avon and this illiterate man having written them, that these Stratfordians like to say the plays were written after 1604, and therefore Edward de Vere died in 1604, so how could he have possibly written them? Very, 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 very simple answer to that. As you say, can you prove a single play was written after 1604? Then all their tongue gets tied and drivel comes out of the bottom of their mouths and they can't prove it. So it's all bollocks. I mean, you can say what you like in as loud as voice as you like, but things don't become true just because you keep saying in them, you keep repeating them. Oxfordians are, to my knowledge, and I know a great deal of them, have much more critical minds, are much cleverer scholars, much brighter scholars than the Stratfordian scholars. And of course, they wouldn't be Oxfordians if there were proof that a play had been written after 1604 when Edward de Vere died. We're not stupid, for heaven's sake. but there is no proof to that effect. And the Oxfordians often reply that actually it's quite impossible for William of Stratford to have written them because we have evidence that certain plays, such as Timon of Athens, for instance, existed as early as 1583, and that's far too early for William of Stratford. Because there was a 14-year difference between William of Stratford and Edward de Vere. Edward de Vere born in 1550, and William of Stratford born in 1564, so there's a 14-year difference. So you can equally argue that these plays have evidence. They seem to be existing when Stratford Shakespeare was far too young to have written them. I mean, barely out of his nappies, let alone got to school, which he never went to anyway. So, that's all rubbish. And I mean, all you need to do is just challenge these people and say, prove to me that a single Shakespeare play was written after this date. Now, there is some evidence that plays were tinkered with, but we know that. We know this for a fact. It's all written up. Everybody's talked about it at the time. They say, you know, plays are brought off the back shelf and dusted up and re-presented at court. And quite often they would jigger a scene around to make it a bit more contemporary, make it a bit more funny, you know, tease someone in the audience or something like that. So there are these little slight contemporary ideas that slip into plays. But we've got all the evidence. We know how that worked. We know from the Henslowe diaries, it's the diaries of a man who ran a theatre company, that he would hire playwrights in order to upgrade these old plays sometimes and dust them off a little bit. But that is absolutely no proof whatsoever that they were written after 1604, or least of all, that William Shakespeare collaborated with other playwrights after 1604 to produce plays. There's absolutely no evidence. And you have all these famous playwrights called Wilkins and Middleton and people like that. But there's actually no evidence that they ever met William Shakespeare, let alone sat around a table and corroborated with him at all. So, I mean, honestly, the Oxfordian industry, if you can call it that, which is so successful now, it really has proven its case and done its point. It simply wouldn't exist if there was anything like the spark of any proper evidence that a William Shakespeare play had been composed anew after 1604.
And of course, Ben Jonson was very close to all of this as well. And he wrote the poem at the front of the folio, which you've done a YouTube video on.
I did. That was the last thing I did. I haven't been very well, sadly, of late. And I like to try and chuck out videos much more often. But the last one I did was a speech I made in London about, I think, the most important contemporary witness to William Shakespeare, if we can call it contemporary. Actually, this long poem, Encomium to William Shakespeare, written after his death and published in the 1623 folio. So it was after both Shakespeare of Stratford and quite a long time after Edward de Vere died. But it tells us, if you read it carefully with a critical mind, it tells us an enormous amount about Shakespeare, and Ben Jonson absolutely clearly wants you just dig into that poem a tiny bit. He clearly knows exactly who William Shakespeare is. He knows it's Edward de Vere through and through, and he drops these golden little hints here, there, and everywhere, right across the poem. And I gave a speech about it, going through the poem, almost line by line. There's still quite a lot more I would like to talk about one day, but had to keep it short. But no, it's fascinating, and one does end up falling in love with a whole lot of these people. They're brilliant, brilliant minds in the games they love to play. And the mere fact that we still have among us, living to this day, people like Professor Sir Stanley Wells, who just never got the joke. They never understood the whole esprit de fantaisie that happened, that was created by this group of people. But you know what, Maudy, this goes much, much deeper than just who wrote the works of Shakespeare. This, I believe, is something really massive. It's a message to mankind. I think I've already mentioned that the First Folio is the second most popular book, English book, in the world. That's to say that Shakespeare's plays are more performed than everybody else's plays put together 400 years after they've been written. And that this is intimately tied in with the publication in 1611 of the King James Bible. And the people who put together these things were a tight group of scholars. All of them seemed to know each other. And I and other scholars who are looking at this are absolutely convinced there's more to it. Everything comes in threes, so there will be a third book somewhere. Now, some people say that third book is something by Francis Bacon called The Great Instauration, which is a book about how all science should work and science methodology, which Bacon never actually finished. Another rather more romantic idea is it's the book that drowned in the tempest. There's a magic book that is drowned. And I think either might be true. I think we might one day discover, long after my lifetime, I suspect, what that third book is. But I will bet every dollar I have in my pocket that there are three books concerned with this great, great mystery. That those books are spellbound, and they're still spellbound to this day. And they are telling us an enormous truth about mankind that goes right back to probably pre-Egyptian, long, long past proto-Masonic truths about the creation and the world, but more importantly, our relationship to God. O man, know yourself. One of the most important sayings ever said, if you understand it. Of course, it doesn't mean just look in the mirror and see if you've got a zit that needs squeezing. It means understand your relationship to the universe and to God. And that is what the great message of these works is, of which I think Shakespeare's one of them.
That was really, really fascinating. Thank you so much, Alexander. Thank you for your time today. And
you're welcome.
For answering pleasure. My questions. And if you would like to know any more, please visit the De Vere Society website. Alexander Waugh also has his own YouTube channel, so you can watch videos on some of the things we've discussed today. Please tell your friends, and we look forward to the next podcast.